Radio Borders Youth Association. Good afternoon, everyone. You are listening to the sound of universal compassion. Please enjoy.
This show is brought to you by the Buddhist Youth Association every Sunday, bringing Buddhism to the community of the Waikato. We also give away a range of free English or Chinese Buddhism books, MP3 or tapes on Buddhism. If you'd like one, please send a letter with $3 worth of stamps in an envelope to P.O. Box 82146, Highland Park, Howick, Auckland. Or you can phone 09271 3377. Buddhist Youth Association, respectful, beneficial, empowering. Hello and welcome to the program once more. Over the last couple of weeks, we haven't stuck very closely to the text we're considering, Namkhon Pel's Mind Training Like the Rays of the Sun. So today, I guess we'd better get back to it, with a background we've gained from taking a few detours, courtesy of Jack Kornfield and Pema Chodron. However, let's for a change start the program thinking about motivation and setting a big one if we find something limited in our mind. If you can, make bodhicitta, the wish to attain enlightenment for all beings, your motivation. For such a motivation brings the greatest benefit. But if you can't do this, at least think about your own liberation from the endlessness of samsara. Thank you. We've looked at the advantages of bodhicitta in the last couple of weeks, and now we come to the part of the text titled Actual Techniques for Cultivating the Awakening Mind. Namkhon Pel explains, the stages for training the mind are explained in two sections, the actual training and the conventional awakening mind, and the five precepts that are factors of the training. The actual training deals with the conventional awakening mind concerned with the welfare of others, which is explained by means of the teaching of exchanging yourself for others and the ways to cultivate the awakening mind that is actually concerned with the interest of others, and the awakening mind concerned with attaining the fully awakened state of being. Now you remember last week's teaching by Pema Chodron that dealt with both of the bodhicittas mentioned here. The conventional awakening mind is the mind that intends to attain enlightenment to benefit all beings, while the fully awakened state of mind refers to ultimate bodhicitta, the ultimate understanding of the nature of reality or living in groundlessness, what Pema Chodron calls the mind that knows no fear. The Namkhon Pel text continues under the subheading Exchanging Yourself with Others Through Acknowledging the Faults of Selfishness and says, the great pioneers have explained in general, cultivating the awakening mind involves the twofold activity of the being concerned with the welfare of others and being concerned with enlightenment. With regard to the first, we should see those sentient beings who are the object of our concern as equally pleasing and agreeable. The ways to achieve this include being led through the method of seven causes and one result. Having realized that relatives arouse feelings of pleasure, enemies arouse feelings of unease, and those who are neither give rise to feelings of indifference, meditate on all beings as being close to you. Although in reality all beings are not your mother, by meditating on recognizing them as your mother, remembering their kindness and wishing to repay it, generate a sense of their being attractive. According to the training that follows the exalted Shantideva's tradition, once we have grasped the many disadvantages of a self-centered attitude, we will be inclined to give it up and generate a sense of sentient beings who are the objects of our concern as being attractive, pleasing, and dear to us. Since the technique of the great conqueror's son Chekawa for cultivating the awakening mind relies upon the latter of these two approaches, his explanation has two sections, showing what is to be given up by contemplating the disadvantages of selfishness and showing what is to be put into practice through contemplating the benefits of concern for others. So he's referring to the two ways in which we can generate bodhicitta. The first, as he says, is the seven cause and one effect method, and the second is exchanging self for others. Of course, we've covered these at various times in the duration of these programs, so you probably know quite well what they are. However, there's no harm in going over them again, particularly for those who've joined the program recently and are unfamiliar with how to generate bodhicitta. Pema Chodron and Jack Kornfield both based the development of bodhicitta through cultivating the four immeasurables. That's immeasurable love, immeasurable compassion, immeasurable joy, and immeasurable equanimity. But the Tibetan tradition follows the two meditations we've already mentioned. Namkar Pal's text uses the second, the exchanging self for others. But as the seven cause and one effect method is mentioned in the text and in His Holiness the Dalai Lama's commentary, let's go through what exactly it means. First, one develops equanimity. This basically means eliminating our innate tendency to categorize beings into friend, enemy, and stranger according to how they relate to us. Those who please us, who do what we want and give us things, we see as friends. We tend to cling to them, and they become important in our life. Those who do not please us, who don't do what we want, and don't accord with how we think they should look, behave, and so on, we class as enemy. We don't necessarily want to kill them, but we have a mind of dislike or aversion to them. Those who are neither nice nor nasty to us, we tend to be indifferent towards. They're the strangers in our lives. This is the way worldly people see other beings. As spiritual practitioners, we need to recognize the fragility of such categories. For instance, friends easily become enemies. Enemies can become friends, and everyone is a stranger before or after being a friend or an enemy. If you think about the friends and enemies you had when you were much younger, you will see how few of them remained in their categories up to now. So we meditate again and again like this until eventually we get a sense of equanimity to all beings, not seeing any as a friend to cling to, an enemy to push away, or a stranger to ignore. Once we have this mind of equanimity, we meditate on seeing all beings as our mother. We can do this in two ways. Recognizing that our mother had a mother, who also had a mother, and so on infinitely, we are related to all beings. Now that's one way. The other is to recognize that we've had infinite lives, and in many we've had a mother. The same being wasn't always our mother. We had different mothers, many of them through our lives. Therefore, we've had infinite mothers and cannot point to any one being and say, that being has never ever been my mother. Every being we've seen, from the biggest elephant to the smallest fly, from the nastiest cockroach to the most beautiful butterfly, has been our mother. When we have that recognition, we think about the kindness of our present mother, how she carried us in her womb for many months, gave birth to us, nurtured us, clothed and fed us, and gave us shelter, gave us protection and education, and all the other myriad ways she was kind to us. If this wasn't our actual mother, we remember the person who most acted like a mother to us. And we remember that all beings who were our previous mothers have been that kind to us. In other words, every single being has shown us such great kindness. Then the next step should be to repay the kindness of our mothers. If our mothers have been that kind to us, then shouldn't we make at least some attempt to repay their kindness? In fact, the Buddha said, we can never repay the kindness of the parents, but that doesn't mean we shouldn't try. And what is the best way to do this? We can see that they are all in some kind of unsatisfactory or miserable state, so wouldn't it be wonderful if we could bring them all complete happiness and peace? That would surely be the best we could do to repay them. And such an intention is called great love. However, to do that, we first have to free them from all their suffering and dissatisfaction. Only when they are completely free will they experience the deep, lasting satisfaction that they so richly deserve and look for. Seeing the great suffering of all beings, I have the overwhelming wish that they be free of all that suffering. And this is great compassion. This wish leads me to taking on the responsibility myself to free them. If I can liberate them in this way, wouldn't it be a wonderful means to in some way repay their infinite kindness to me? But at the moment, I cannot even free myself from suffering, never mind all other beings. Most of the dissatisfaction and suffering I go through, I can do little about. So who can actually free beings from their suffering? Who can totally eliminate the suffering of beings? Well, no one can just remove it with a finger snap. But a Buddha who can look into others' minds and see exactly what they need can teach beings exactly what they need to free themselves. And only a Buddha has the greatest capacity to free beings in this way. Therefore, I must become a Buddha, so that I am in the best situation to free all these beings, my kind mothers, from their infinite sufferings. I will perfect all the teachings that lead to the state of Buddhahood so that I can be of greatest benefit to all these beings, my kind mothers. And that is the one result, bodhicitta. This is then, in brief, the method of six cause and one effect to develop bodhicitta. The six causes are, first, seeing all beings as one's mother, then second, remembering their kindness. The third cause is wishing to repay their kindness, and that leads on to the fourth, great love, the wish that all beings have happiness. From great love comes great compassion, the wish that all these mother beings be free from their suffering. That in turn leads to the superior intention, to take on the responsibility to free beings from their suffering. And from that comes bodhicitta, the intention to attain enlightenment as the best way to benefit beings in whatever way they need, but especially to lead them to enlightenment, the ultimate in omniscience and freedom from all suffering. So this is what Namkar Pal is referring to when talking about the seven-part cause and effect method, sometimes called six cause and one effect method. In explaining this part of Namkar Pal's text, His Holiness the Dalai Lama says, "The actual methods for developing conventional bodhicitta are equalizing and exchanging our attitudes about self and others, and the seven-part cause and effect meditation. Both of these methods have as their basis developing a heartwarming state of love for others. Heartwarming love is an automatic feeling of closeness and warmth whenever we meet anyone. We cherish and are deeply concerned about them and would feel badly if anything went wrong for them. According to the seven-part cause and effect method, to develop this heartwarming type of love, we first need to develop an equal attitude or equanimity towards others, with which we feel neither attachment, aversion, nor neglect of anyone. We recognize everyone as having been our mothers, acknowledge and remain mindful of their kindness, and being grateful and wishing to repay it, we develop this heartwarming love for them. Exchanging our attitude towards self and others comes from Shantideva's tradition. We don't have to belabor the point of everyone having been our mother, but simply think in general how we all want to be happy, how nobody wants suffering or problems, exactly like ourselves. In this regard, we're all equal on that level. We see how cherishing ourselves is the root of all problems, while cherishing others is the root of all good qualities. We need to think, since I do want happiness and I do want happiness, I must give up self-cherishing and develop the attitude of cherishing others. So, on the basis of realizing the equality of self and others, we develop this heartwarming love for others and we change our attitude with respect to them. This is a very extensive method. Both ways of developing a bodhicitta aim, exchanging our attitude towards self and others, and the seven-part cause and effect method, get us to this point of the heartwarming love for others. His Holiness goes on, "Depending on a person's disposition, developing the attitude of recognizing everybody as my mother can sometimes involve problems. We might develop it in terms of considering ourselves very important. I'm really someone very important, and because I'm important, my mother is also very important. And so we develop this feeling that I want to help my mother because she's my mother, and we want to develop and help all beings because they have all been my mother. There's this great emphasis placed on me and my in this way of developing bodhicitta. That point is the danger in this instruction. If, on the other hand, we think of exchanging our attitude about self and others, wanting to help others not simply because they've been my own mother, but because they don't want problems and they want happiness just as I do, there's far less danger. We're no longer involved with the considerations of me and mine, and so it becomes a far more extensive way of reaching out to all others and developing a bodhicitta aim. We don't just think of the kindness of others when they've been our mother, but we think of the kindness of everybody, how they've always been kind to us in all ways. So this is basically a discussion of how we work out both methods together, the seven-part cause and effect training and the equalizing and exchanging of self and others. That's His Holiness the Dalai Lama. We now come to the technique of exchanging self for others. As I've stressed before, this doesn't mean swapping your body or mind for the body or mind of someone else. It means changing our usual self-cherishing attitude for the attitude that cherishes others above oneself. And here we have to be careful, because for Westerners, this may appear to mean not caring for oneself. We tend to think that caring for others means we don't take care of ourselves. Remember the response to Ajahn Brahm's story about the head monk who refused to make a choice about which of his community was to be killed. As Ajahn Brahm asked, "Why is it that most in my audience thought that the head monk would choose himself to die? Why is it in our culture that we are always sacrificing ourselves for others and this is held to be good? Why is it that we are more demanding, critical, and punishing of ourselves than of anyone else? It is for one and the same reason. We've not yet learned to love ourselves. If you find it difficult to say to another, 'The door of my heart is open to you, whatever you do,' then that difficulty is trifling compared with the difficulty you will face in saying to yourself, 'Me, the one I've been close to for as long as I can remember, myself, the door to my heart is open to me as well. All of me, no matter what I've done, come in.' That's what I mean by loving ourselves. It's called forgiveness. It's stepping free from the prison of guilt. It is being at peace with oneself. And if you do find the courage to say those words to yourself honestly in the privacy of your own world, then you will rise up, not down, to meet sublime love. One day, we all have to say to ourselves those words, or similar, with honesty, not playing games. When we do, it is as if part of ourselves that had been rejected, living outside in the cold for so long, has now come home. We feel unified, whole, and free to be happy. Only when we lose ourselves in such a way can we know what it means to really love another, no more and no less. So this is also part of exchanging self for others. It is a way of seeing that oneself is no different from others. So we look after ourselves just as well as we look after others. As His Holiness often says, the best way to look after oneself is to look after others. Be wisely selfish, he says. Anyway, let's get back to Nam Karpel, who starts describing the technique of exchanging self for others. He opens with the aphorism, "Banish the one to blame for everything." Banish the one to blame for everything. Then he explains what is meant by the one we should be blaming for everything. We sentient beings run after the misery that we do not desire and never achieve what we wish, he writes. At the root of it all, we seek to lay the blame elsewhere, which is a mistake. This is because all the various lengthy and violent sufferings that come from being born among the five or six kinds of existence, from the hell without respite to the peak of existence, are not without causes, nor do they arise from unrelated causes. These come about independence upon the actions and disturbing emotions that give rise to everything. Since actions are caused by disturbing emotions are the primary factor. Moreover, amongst the disturbing emotions, it is the ignorance that clutches onto the misconception of self that is the principal source of all misery. When something goes wrong, or not how we wish, we tend to immediately lay the blame on other people or outside circumstances. In an article, "Stop Playing the Blame Game," on the website of Psychology Today, Dr. Elliot D. Cohen lists many examples. Someone is late to the family holiday dinner and is treated by the host as a persona non grata for the remainder of the night. given the cold shoulder, given dirty looks, or even reprimanded before the other guests. A motorist goes down the wrong way in a parking lot and receives the middle finger from another motorist. A student fails an exam and subsequently becomes belligerent towards the teacher and makes nasty comments to other students about the teacher. A teacher consistently gets poor student evaluations and blames the students for being incompetent and too stupid to evaluate him. A man beats up his wife and blames the victim for not understanding him. A woman cheats on her husband and blames him for working too much. A manager does not get the promotion she wanted and blames her boss for being a male chauvinist pig. I'm sure we can all think of many examples in our life where we or others around us find the blame anywhere but with ourselves. In each such situation, with a little insight, we can readily recognize the emotion that makes us upset: anger, fear, hatred. And if we look even further, we can see the big I behind it, feeling threatened or hard done by. The latecomer to the dinner party insulted me, the host. The motorist going the wrong way in the parking lot offends my sense of right of way. The teacher didn't give me enough instruction to pass the exam. The students are too stupid to give me a proper evaluation. I beat my wife because she doesn't understand me, and so on. Each of the disturbing emotions is driven by this self-reference. And yet, if I were to ask you to describe precisely this I that gets so offended, what would you say? Could you describe it? At the time of offense, it appears so strong, so real, and so powerful. But when we take the time out to look at it, to try and find it, what do we find? It is very difficult to pinpoint, even to adequately describe. That is because it's a fiction. And yet, on the basis of this, I'm quite ready to act harmfully, even viciously, out of anger, pride, or any of the other disturbing emotions. Such actions then place negative imprints on our mind stream, which will in due course ripen into suffering experiences for us. This misconceiving the I to exist as independently and inherently behind the emotions, the actions, and the resultant playing out of karma. That is why in Nampkar Pal's next quote from Guide to the Bodhisattva's Way of Life, Shantideva calls this I the great ghost. It appears so powerfully, and yet when we look for it, it cannot be found anywhere. The quote goes like this: however much torment, fear, and suffering there is in the world, it all arises from the misconceptions of self. Oh, what trouble this great ghost brings me. Then Namkar Pal continues, furthermore, since disturbing emotions, chiefly created by seizing onto a misconception of self, brings us harm, they are the actual adversary. We should not maintain relations with this long-term antagonist. And again, he quotes Shantideva, thus, through long, unbroken contact, he is our foe, sole cause of an ever-increasing heap of trouble. When we are certain of this in our hearts, how can we be happy and unafraid in cyclic existence? The more we think about this, the more obvious it becomes that the grasping at and cherishing of this I brings us all our torment. Examine carefully all the troubles in your life, and you will begin to see that common to all of them is the sense of a threatened me. Namkar Pal continues, moreover, we can attribute all these harms to our selfish attitude, and think of how it slams the door on all benefits and accomplishments, we should beware of it. Cherishing this I makes us think so much of ourselves and our own entitlement that we don't care about harming others and getting what we want. This leads us to create negative karma, which in turn not only prevents us from progressing spiritually, but also obstructs our goals in this life. Harming others or being mean to them, we forget that we actually depend on them for all our well-being and happiness. How could we get food, clothes, and shelter, in fact everything we use and rely on and enjoy, if it wasn't for others? And when we arrive in a difficult situation and need help, how can we expect to rely on others if we've been mean and nasty to them? Thus, the self-cherishing attitude slams the door on all benefits and accomplishments. That is why, in the next paragraph, Namkapel says, the self-centered attitude is an expression of stupid ignorance, since this lack of consideration for others is like taking hold of the sharp weapon of wrong views and slaughtering any concern for good and bad deeds. So right here within us is a butcher who cuts off the source of life of high status and definite goodness. High status and definite goodness here refers to gaining liberation and Buddhahood. Namkapel goes on, the selfish thought holding up the bag of the three poisons is the thief within us who destroys our harvest of virtue. By collecting rotten, worthless things in the cave of our heart, we have here within us an owl-headed deceiver who attracts all human and inhuman interferences. When based on the self-cherishing attitude, we familiarize ourselves with the three poisons, that is attachment, aversion, and ignorance. We not only create negative deeds and karma, but also weaken our positive qualities. So we're not accumulating the causes for future happiness, but are actually collecting harmful imprints in our consciousness, which Namkapel calls rotten, worthless things in the cave of our hearts. He says, the self-cherishing attitude is a deceiver because it always promises us happiness, but actually only delivers suffering. When we are angry with someone, for instance, the reasons for our anger and why we should harm them appear very reasonable and persuasive. We will get some satisfaction out of humiliating them, causing them pain, but this is deceptive. Our satisfaction will be very short-lived, and the negative tendencies on our minds will bring much suffering in the future. We can say the same about attachment. It promises us so much, but in the end, it only brings us dissatisfaction, unending thirst for more, and suffering. Therefore, the self-cherishing attitude behind the three poisons is totally a deceiver. As Namkapel continues, in the fields of action are planted the seeds of consciousness, irrigating them over and over again with the waters of desire and craving is the farmer here within us who cultivates the numerous shoots of the five or six kinds of suffering beings. Even though the previous Buddhas, the transcendent subduers, have spent as long as us in this beginningless world, we have been unable to adhere to any of the excellent qualities of this or the world beyond. So here within us is a naked, empty-handed slob behaving overindulgently. Oh, strong words, don't you think? But if we look at all our actions, are they not motivated by self-cherishing? Just about everything we do, even our so-called spiritual actions, have an element of craving happiness and avoiding suffering for myself above all others. When we create actions with this type of motivation, we plant in our consciousness imprints or seeds that will ripen into further experiences in the various samsaric realms. We find it's very difficult to take ourselves under control, as the Buddhas of the past did, and destroying the self-grasping and self-cherishing attitudes, reap all the benefits of this human existence. Even when we try, our familiarity with selfishness spoils our good intentions and makes us act badly. Then not only do we not take advantage of all that this precious human rebirth offers us, but we forsake what we could have attained if we'd exercised the same control the enlightened ones have. We shouldn't think that the Buddhas popped up out of nowhere as highly realized beings with qualities far beyond our own. Once upon a time, each Buddha was like myself, just an ordinary being cycling endlessly in samsara. The difference between me and the Buddhas is that they've made a firm intention to put an end to samsaric existence and then put effort into proceeding steadily along the spiritual path until they reach nirvana. I haven't made that determination and don't expend that effort, and so I remain in samsara. That's something to think about over the next week, as we've now run out of time and must say farewell. Please dedicate to attaining enlightenment for the benefit of all beings. Thanks and goodbye until next week.